Yeah, Z, make your way in here, buddy. We're singling people out now. This is that sort of event. All right, this seems about as good a time as any. Welcome, everybody, all of you, to Talon Bar and the Independent Labor Assembly number one. We are the Independent Labor Club of New York. This is our first public assembly meeting, which we will be doing monthly, bi-monthly, moving forward, posing for ourselves with guests and among ourselves important questions that we feel need answering in this moment in time. The ILC, we are proud to announce, is not just a New York concern any longer. There is a Arizona chapter that has popped up outside of Phoenix, which we're super excited about. Other chapters who seek to form, but we're not sure we have the infrastructure right now to manage things all over the country or in Australia, as the case may be. People in Australia want to get something going. We'll get there. We will get there. We are proud, very proud, to have an excellent guest with us today for this assembly. We have Gregory Butler. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's been a while since you've done a public event, is that right?
Almost a decade now.
Almost a decade. So we got a guest, a rare guest, let's call it. Gregory is a retired local union 608 carpenter. Woo! New York City District Council of Carpenters. Currently a Department of Buildings inspector, is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah. We have DOB fans out there. The webmaster of Gangbox News, which you've been doing for, 25 years now at this point?
In one format or another since 1998.
1998, folks. Some of you weren't even born then. And the author of, and you can see it up here in the front, the book Disunited Brotherhood, Race, Racketeering, and the Fall of the New York Construction Unions. So thanks so much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
As folks might know, I am also a member of the New York City District Council of Carpenters. So we're here to talk shop. We're here to talk about your experience, and I can share some of my experience. But most importantly, you've written a lot over the years about what you saw as a rank-and-file militant worker in the Carpenters Union. You've talked about the history of the trades, the history of the working class in this city, which over the years I'm sure you've seen has had its rises and its falls.
That is correct, yeah.
I guess the first question we want to ask you here is how did you get into the trades and how did you get into radical politics, Marxist politics?
Okay, well, the radicalism came first. My parents were radical leftists, so I pretty much grew up in a far-left environment, and my parents have been radicals for many, many years prior to me being born. And I grew up around left-wing politics, and I basically started being a politically active when I was about 13 years old, which was in 1982 when Ronald Reagan was president. And I joined the Young Communist League USA in 1985. Picked a good time to join it, right? Just a couple years before the Soviet Union fell.
Yeah.
So, and that's when they still got, they and their parent organization, the Communist Party, was still funded by the Soviet government, actually.
Moscow Gold.
Oh, no, literally about $2 million a year.
It's not bad.
And I was around when they cut the money off, and there was a split in the party over it. Nominally, it was politics, but it was also suddenly there was a bunch of people on the payroll, and the budget to pay them was no longer there because Chairman Gorbachev cut the money off. So, and like much of the American left, and we'll go into this later, and this is a recurring theme in the American left, a lot of what the CPUSA did was basically being a straight-ticket Democrat with extra steps.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much that one sentence describes the entire American left for about the last 60 years. So that's essentially what they did. And as far as how I became a carpenter, right after high school, I tried the college thing. It was not for me. And I figured out what I was going to do for it, what was I going to do with the rest of my life. Oh, is my audio good? Okay.
Yeah, everyone can hear, right? All right, excellent.
Okay, everyone in the back can hear me. Outstanding. All right, so I got a job working in a factory that made pizza ovens. I spent about 2 years there, and I figured, and then I bounced around a few jobs, and then I eventually got in the Carpenters Union apprenticeship in 1992. And I did a 4-year apprenticeship. That was when the New York construction unions were still run by Cosa Nostra. That is to say, the organized crime syndicate, commonly known as the Mafia.
The thing of theirs, not the thing of ours.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I did a 4-year apprenticeship. Basically, I did a whole bunch of stuff as an apprentice, as a journeyman. I mainly did office furniture and trade show exhibits. And also metal and glass partitions. And I became a shop steward fairly early on, and I took it seriously in a way that you're apparently not really supposed to do. So that was an interesting experience.
So you caught some flack for that, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I one time was threatened with being arrested for trespassing in the building I was working in.
Oof.
And I also... one time there was a local union president named Sylvester Little Sal Zarzana, and as you could tell, Italian man with a colorful nickname. Yes, he was in fact a what is known as a made guy. He was a captain in the Genovese crime family, and he had his secretary phone me to come to his office so he could beat me up.
Better the office, maybe, than come meet me down by the Gowanus Canal.
And, well, you know, and I, needless to say, declined to accept Little Sal's invitation. And, well, like I said, that's why I ended up doing that. I did that for like about, I did a 4-year apprenticeship, worked as a journeyman off and on for 20 years. And carpentry is a very sporadic job, union carpentry. It's not like having a real job. It's like you're basically a very highly paid day laborer. And especially, it's still a very racist industry, so it's like there's a racial hierarchy and who gets work, and I happen to be African-American. I'm not on the, I'm on the wrong end of that racial hierarchy. And also, being a shop steward and a union activist that took the whole unionism thing seriously creates problems because, well, there's lots of employers that do things they're not supposed to do, and there are people who run the union who take payoffs from these people to let them do that. And I was an obstacle to that, and this caused problems. So eventually I did that until about 2016, and then I got a real job. I went to work for the city of New York, which is where I work currently.
Quite a history. You've seen a lot in those years, and you've documented that over the years in Gangbox News, which I was familiar with, I think, even before I joined the trades, which was in the early teens, just as like an excellent resource to talk about these issues. And of course, eventually that all gets compiled into your excellent book, which we'll talk about. Some of the themes that you brought up, which we want to get back to, are, of course, race, because you write a lot about, I mean, it's disunited brotherhood, right? Race and racketeering. You write a lot about that. The way in which organized crime came to substitute for workers' militancy in the building trades. We're definitely going to touch on that. Before we get to that and questions of the popular front and politics and what ILC is trying to do and what you've been trying to do, I guess let's talk about who influenced you. I know for a fact that both you and I think you personally, but me secondarily, were influenced by a guy by the name of Bob Fitch. I don't know if there's any Bob Fitch fans out there, but we have some heads nodding. Assassination of New York, of course, is a wonderful book, a powerful book about the way in which finance, insurance, and real estate interests basically worked with the city, worked with other capitalists and developers to change the entire political economy of the city starting in the 1960s, 70s, and certainly by 80s and 90s. And the other was a very controversial book, still is, called Solidarity for Sale, where Bob Fitch went off the reservation and he started talking about things people aren't supposed to talk about, which is business unions essentially operating as labor rackets. And racketeering, of course, being a part of that, but only kind of coming out of the actual structure of these, skilled worker, yellow dog, company-loving business unions that we all love so much. So talk about your general influences and talk about Bob Fitch, who you knew, right?
Yeah, I knew him personally because I, at one point around 1980, would have been 1996, I started writing for a publication called Hard Hat News. It was a zine. It was printed on like a little, like a little booklet, and it was a little new. This is before the internet was the thing. You had to actually, you wanted to agitate them with people, you had to print stuff out and physically hand it to people. Well, I met Bob while I was, I volunteered to write for them. I met him. We got to know each other pretty well. I got to see how he thought, and had his thing about Dr. Fitch or about Bob was that he was one of the few scholars of labor history that I have ever met who has actually honestly described American trade unionism, the stuff they do that they actually are good at, and the stuff they do that they're actually terrible at. Because unfortunately, most people who write about the labor movement, most of the academics who study the labor movement, most of the people who teach labor studies in our universities, the people who you see lecturing about labor and stuff, you know, people like Nelson Lichtenstein, people like that, most of them are on one or another union payroll. And if you work for a labor union, those jobs are patronage jobs. Mm-hmm. That's at-will job. There's some union official that gave you that job, and union officials, and I've met quite a few of them, as a group, are a fairly terrible group of human beings. You never want to work for a labor union. They're awful people. And if you don't toe the line, you get fired.
You know, sorry to interrupt, but I had it in, I had a fight with that dude, Eric Loomis, on Twitter the other day. He calls himself an academic union thug. Like, what the fuck? What does that even mean, man?
It's like, sir, you're a tenured professor.
Yeah, seriously.
And yeah, I saw that, and it was very, he's, Dr. Loomis is very typical of the sort of people who write about labor. He's basically like, you know, I was alive, an adult and a communist when the Soviet Union and East Germany still were countries. I occasionally got to meet people who were, did journalism, and I'm doing air quotes, for those countries, and basically they were propagandists. It was very much the Joseph Goebbels school of journalism. And that is how most people who write about labor and actually get funded by the American labor unions, that's how they write. They're propagandists. They're not journalists. They're propagandists. Like the sort of people who would have been writing for Pravda when Marshall Stalin was alive, the sort of people who would be writing for the People's Daily when Mao Zedong was alive, that is the sort of people who do labor scholarship. And that's where, getting back to Bob, is where Bob fits in, because Bob actually wrote, honestly, he had opinions that he had formed based on his studies. He actually was doing actual, you know, actual academic work regarding the labor movement and forming theories about it, and they don't like that. So one of the reasons he never got the sort of respect and the sort of position that academia he should have had when he was still with us was because he was honest about them. Mm. They don't like that.
They don't like that. I recall from Solidarity for Sale, his first, Bob Fitch, and Bob passed away 20-something years ago, right? Yeah, he had cancer. He passed away. Describing his own experience, I think working the summer as a laborer, working paving,
yeah.
And he ended up getting shaken down or something like that on the job.
Yeah.
A similar studier of labor would be also Mike Davis, too, who was a Teamster right. for a little bit. I feel like there is a divide between people who, you know, had a hand in working and then like the larger kind of staffer slash academic universe out there, which is very much there to, of course, make a living, but also to justify, I think, a lot of the things that are very unjustifiable
right.
these days in the labor movement. Not to, you know, get too much on this Eric Loomis character. I don't really know the guy from a hole in the wall, but he was defending the National Labor Relations Board, yeah. and he was defending the Democrats as the great protectors of organized labor in this. Thank you. That is the correct reaction to that. As though 6% labor density in the private sector is something to be excited about.
You know, actually, we're at the point where the Islamic Republic of Sudan has higher private sector union density than the United States.
There you have it.
That is the point where we're at right now. And that country is an underdeveloped country. It's also a military dictatorship. And they have a stronger labor movement than we do. And that is, obviously, our labor leaders are not doing what they should be doing if that is the situation, especially considering the budget, the entire budget of the Trades Union Council of Sudan is probably less than what your typical international union spends on golf junkets.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Bob Fitch is an influence. You were influenced, obviously, by radicalism in your youth and Communist Party stuff. In your book, I want to kind of switch gears a little bit here. In your book, you excavate for us, I think, a really important hidden history, which is the history of the integration of the building trades union, which we may not know, were lily white up until the 60s, 70s, 80s. There were various attempts by the state, and I'm going to let you tell the story, to integrate. There was the Philadelphia plan, the New York plan, running up against the great intransigence of these basically like ethnic labor rackets that existed. But people don't really know the history of the coalitions. And I'm not sure if anybody, nod your head if you know what the coalition is. I ran into the coalition last year on the job. Guy got laid off in a van, a guy showed up, and I let the super deal with that one. Not my problem. He was a concrete laborer. But talk a little bit about what was really these civil social organizations, right, which had a great hand in integrating the trades in a way that the progressive state ultimately didn't.
Okay, so basically, construction unions were founded roughly around the time slavery ended. I mean, some of the earliest unions date back to like the New York District Council of Carpenters dates back to 1850. But most of the unions were founded pretty much around the time of the end of the Civil War, because really, it wasn't really possible to unionize construction at a time when about half the construction workers in the country were actual slaves, which was the case up until the Civil War. But when they were founded on a racially segregated basis. They would organize black workers, but often they would be in segregated locals. Sometimes the local would be run by the colored local. Yes, that's what they called it. Would be under the supervision of an adjacent white local. And of course, in some areas, that would be in the South, where there were so many black workers in the industry, you couldn't not organize them. The further north you got, generally it would tend to be all white. Where possible, they would exclude black workers. So this continued for a very long period of time. Unions were much stronger then than they are now, by the way. And again, we'll get into that later, why. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward, 1960s, civil rights movement, and the government had to make certain concessions to the civil rights movement, one of which was the equal employment laws, that they had to let black workers and other minority workers into these industries. And initially, there were attempts by the government to integrate construction, but they were done in a very, very limited way. They would basically be the very limited, half-hearted attempts to enforce these civil rights laws. What happened here in New York? In New York, there were a number of Maoists who were workers of color who worked in the trades who built these workers' organizations. The first one was a group called Harlem Fight Back. It was run by a man named Jim Horton, who I met back in the day. And there were other groups that ended up emerging. There was a group in Chinatown led by a gentleman named Wing Lam that I also met back in the day. And there were a number of these groups. And they basically, you'd have these small neighborhood organizations. It'd be a small group of workers in an area. And they would get these old school buses. And they'd go around to construction sites. And they would basically make the contractors stop working.
To give context for people, as you describe in your book, and I was at Harlem Hospital working last year, and in addition, you would have like housing projects going up in Harlem, or you'd have a big like middle class like Marshall Llama construction going up in Chinatown. Yeah. Meanwhile, 100% of the workers working in these neighborhoods would be white workers, white skilled tradesmen.
Confucius Plaza, which was the first job that the Chinese Construction Workers Association integrated, job in the middle of Chinatown. It's on the Bowery near Bayard Street, and it's a fairly large building. It's still there to this day. Mm-hmm. Being built with an all-white crew in the middle of Chinatown. So they would go, and they'd go up to these sites, and they would literally yell the words, stop working, and they would make them stop the job, and they would make contractors hire minority workers on the site. And that's how a lot of people got in the union, because these were back then, most of the industry in New York was still union, and if you get hired on a union job, the different unions were different, but if you got hired as a carpenter or a laborer on a union job, they had to let you in the union.
You had to get your book.
So they couldn't not let you in the union, and technically, some of the other trades, like the plumbers, had clauses in their constitution that said their membership was restricted to Caucasians. That's a direct quote. But Carpenters Union, because the people that founded it back in the day were socialists,
mm-hmm.
they technically were an integrated union. So you got hired as a carpenter, they got to let you in the union, and they did. And that is pretty much how the trades got integrated in New York. Wasn't the government, wasn't a gift from the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. wasn't a gift from Lyndon Johnson. It was a bunch of black, Latino, and Chinese American workers who were led by people who were communists. Now, of course, once you're running a labor organization and you're actually doing American style labor, well, labor relations adjacent stuff, that changes you. And within a few years, most of the people who ran these coalitions who had been progressive labor party style Maoist communists a few years earlier, essentially quickly make the transition to being wise guys.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly make transition of being gangsters and shaking down companies, shaking down the workers. And this is a transition that happened in the building trades back in the 19th century. People like the father of May Day, Peter J. McGuire, also the founder of the Carpenters Union, also the founder of Labor Day. He's a socialist. Within 20 years of him passing away, his successors are basically Irish gangsters. And that's who runs the Carpenters Union nationally for most of the 20th century. Bunch of wise guys. A guy named Big Bill Hutchison. And then when he died, he gave the union to his son. Mm. Yes, his son inherited the union. Maurice Hutchison.
It's like North Korea, right?
Yeah, very much like that.
Well, I think Big Bill Hutchinson was the one that got punched in the face by John Lewis of the mine workers when they broke off to form the CIO.
Yeah, at the 1935 CIO convention. That is correct, yeah.
So we're looking at something then in the way that the trades are structured and more broadly American labor is structured, that it doesn't matter if a trade union is formed by socialists. It doesn't matter if they're formed by Maoists. There's something about the hiring hall. There's something about the structure, let's say the parasitic nature of the various rackets that exist in the United States, these skilled labor monopolization schemes that structurally leads towards corruption. Exactly. And that corruption, as you point out, I think very eloquently in the book, isn't merely just wise guys, because wise guys is the tip of the iceberg, right? Underneath that is an entire party structure, is an entire, certainly by the second half of the 20th century, an entire non-governmental organization structure, these community board organizations that you mentioned in the book, that aren't wise guys. In fact, they're connected to the state and they're connected to quote-unquote democratic institutions like capitalist parties. But yet they too serve this sort of parasitic function in the trade unions. So talk a little bit about how these coalitions, and I think you mentioned there was like 50-something of them at a certain point, how they not only became wise guys themselves, but got integrated into the NGO kind of democratic party structure.
Well, just to pull the lens back a little bit, one of the things about American unions, and we're going to get into this earlier when we talk about the NLRB later on. When we get official American-style trade unionism, where you get certified by the government and you represent a particular bargaining unit, very early on, a lot of American unions got very heavily into doing things like being insurance brokers, which is now most of what the American labor movement does. A typical union member, your main point of contact with the union is that insurance card. And that is, it moved them away from being organizations of struggle by workers into being essentially sort of social services operations / insurance brokers. And in the building trades, the unions run a network of trade schools, and they also run temp agencies for the employees, the hiring hall, which hiring halls, I've often heard people, leftists who've never worked through a hiring hall, speak very highly of them. If you've ever actually worked through them, it's very much like a temp agency, only slightly worse.
Mm.
So it's the nature of that. When you're the junior partners in a labor management government partnership, when you are the people who basically are essentially doing HR subcontracting for the employer, you're dealing with conflicts. You're dealing with, like in the civil service unions, if someone has a civil service issue or the disciplinary issue, the union is basically, let's service. They're like legal aid. They're a lawyer or attorney referral service. They get you an attorney. They resolve that. It ceases to be organizations of workers, and it's more like when you get locked up and you call legal aid. Mm. More like when, oh, you got to go to the doctor because you burned your hand and you got to call Blue Cross. It's more like that.
It's a service. And so dues then are what you pay for the service. It's not a membership organization based on democratic principles and workers' struggles. It's instead like Aetna, right?
Basically. It's basically like Allstate or like Geico or like Esurance. It's an insurance company. And a lot of people, if you talk to a lot of union workers about unionism, a lot of them basically conceptualize it. It's like paying for insurance. And a lot of the unions in their propaganda materials they aim at their members, they often speak of joining a union as taking out an insurance policy. And I can say this as having been a delegate in my current union with the city, a lot of what you do when you're pitching people on joining the union is you're basically selling them, well, it's like when you pay for insurance, because that's very much what it is. There's this really insipidly stupid slogan that you see in union social media. The union is you. The union is an organization of workers. It was 100 years ago.
Mm.
Has it been since the National Labor Relations Act? Absolutely not. It's an insurance company. It's like, you know, it's like you have a fire in your house and you call Allstate and you can make a claim on your home insurance policy. That's what it is. And that is why basic self-defense stuff for workers, basically fighting for our rights on the job, let alone fighting to advance us as a class. American Union stopped doing that about a century ago, and they basically went full bore into doing insurance stuff. I mean, in part because it's very profitable.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Why do American labor unions, with their shrinking membership, why do they have about 300,000 people that work for labor unions in this country? A lot of these people make a lot of money. A lot of the people that work for my union make more money than me. I make a pretty decent salary. I make about $70,000 a year. President of my union, the international president, makes $500,000 a year.
That's pretty good.
And that's the president of his union, the carpenters. He makes $500,000 a year. He lives in a mansion in Las Vegas.
And I mean, it's obvious why someone would go for that, right? Because if you're bargaining concessions, you're doing givebacks, right? You're signing project labor agreements like we work under all the time, which takes maybe 10% out of the envelope, your vacation and your pension or whatever. You know, the guy making $500,000 a year isn't getting that cut. Of course, it's the members themselves. I have like a trollish question on here, because the questions for this interview, this discussion right here, because this is an ILC event, don't just come from me as like a podcast guy, but okay. You know, all of us in the group, we came together. One of the trollish questions I had, though, is that now that mob influence, let's say, since the state, local, federal, state turned against the mob in like the 70s and 80s and 90s, and now they're not as much a going concern, at least the Italians, like they used to be. Is it any better or worse now that the mob is gone, but we have a bunch of Cornell educated staffers and Democratic Party adjuncts in charge of things? Is it better or worse now?
It's worse in different ways.
Okay. All right. Good answer.
Just to flesh that answer out, when the wise guys ran it, first of all, the unions were a lot stronger, and the basis of the wise guy's power was that unions were still strong enough to do strikes. So basically, they were doing extortion. They were doing what are called protection rackets. They're doing, in some cases, like in the trucking industry, they were outright stealing the cargo the companies were shipping. If you've ever seen the film Goodfellas,
mm-hmm.
where they're robbing Kennedy Airport, and by the way, that's based on a true story. Those are all based on real people.
I may or may not have had a great uncle who lost his job at Lufthansa over that. But, you know, that's for a different program, maybe behind the paywall. We'll see.
Well, the thing is, that's a lot of what they did. But the basis of that was these unions actually had some social power base, and they still had some vestiges of the time that they could lead strikes. And they would shake these companies down for money. Plus, a lot of the lower-level wise guys actually at some point had actually worked in the trades. I mean, I had a foreman once, Vincent Gigante Jr., whose father was Vincent
the Chin.
Vincent the Chin.
Chin Jr.
Yeah. And Vincent Jr., very nice person, by the way. He was an actual carpenter. He was an actual carpenter foreman. He went to work at the Javits Center until he got kicked out for being Vincent the Chin's son and living there in the hotels. He still works there to this day. These people were actually came from a trades background, but they just ran the rackets in the trades. But as the unions decayed, and also as the unions decayed, the companies got tired of the payoffs.
Mm-hmm.
They got tired of the tribute. The 2% tribute, if you're doing a concrete job in New York.
Sammy the Bull Gravano takes his 2%. We all know that out there, right?
And, you know.
Sammy's gone now.
If you were doing a concrete job in New York City and it was worth more than $2 million, you had to go to a pizza shop in East Harlem and meet a gentleman by the name of Anthony Fat Tony Salerno.
Mm.
And you had to give him 2% of the price of the job, and he'd tell you who would you would hire to do the job, what contract you'd hire. And if it was more than $10 million, you were hiring a company called SNA Concrete, which happened to be owned by Fat Tony.
Mm.
And, well, when the union ceased to have the social power to back this up with strikes, suddenly, oh, you have to go to a pizza shop and pay some this guy all this money, or you have to go, or if you were doing drywall work, you'd have to go up to the Bronx to a real estate office, and you have to meet a man named Louis Muscatello, and he would tell you what drywall contractor you're going to use, how much you were going to pay, and you had to pay Mr. Muscatello 2% of the price of the job.
I got to say, Greg, it is great that you're with us here today with these stories, because there was a chance that you wouldn't be with all these names you're dropping. I respect it.
And you know, when I was a carpenter for much of that time, these people were still active, and I was writing about them.
Oh man,
and naming names, and you know. This was, because it was so high profile, they kind of couldn't do anything to me because I was kind of a minor celebrity in the trades, and I was kind of, anything happened to me would be an issue, but they were aware of me.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, it's Greg Butler. It's the guy that writes the letters. That's what they used to refer to, my essays that I wrote on my blog, they referred to them as letters.
Your Marxist missives were your letters. Well, for the context, you know, because when you grow up in America and you hear about corruption in the building trades or in the Teamsters, of course, you know, Jimmy Hoffa and all that stuff, you say, wow, union, so corrupt. How do they ever get away with this? It was an entire ecosystem. Because the contractors and the subcontractors and Sammy the Bull with the concrete or whoever, it was all part of a larger ecosystem that was taking cuts from all parts of that. So people want to solely blame, you know, these decrepit, decayed, degenerate workers' organizations, when in fact it was like an entire internal economy within development and building, right?
I mean, basically what happened was in the early 20th century, problem you had in New York City, at the largest construction market in North America, but you had all these companies competing, and that tended to drive the prices down, and that made it difficult for them to make money. So way back in 1912, there was a gentleman named Robert Brundell, who was not an Italian guy, but pioneered labor rackets. He actually ran your local.
Oh, my local. Yeah, okay.
And he came up with the idea of organizing the industry and organizing so who got what job and how much they got to bid, and they were setting a floor under the prices, and that served a social function for the industry. Clients didn't like it because they had to pay more, but it organized and regularized the industry and the unions, which still had some strong vestiges of their origin as socialist-led organizations of workers. The power of the strike was the basis which they used to... That was what they used as a club to enforce these rackets. So... Now, Brundell got swept away fairly early on. He was the first person in the United States to ever be prosecuted for racketeering in 1921. But other people took his place, and Cosa Nostra were better organized than the Irish wise guys were, so they ended up taking it over. But again, as the unions decayed, and as we go from pre-Wagner Act unionism, which is you get a bunch of workers together, you go on strike, you make the companies sign an agreement, and or if you're doing, like, in a trade, you get a bunch of people who work in that trade for different employers in the same area. You go on strike. You impose those conditions on everybody. So everybody, there's a level playing field. Everyone's paying this labor cost, and they have to compete. And that, as it fades away, and you have post-1935, post-National Labor Relations Act unionism, where there's these government-run elections, and you have this whole specialized process of signing an agreement, and you can't just say go and impose unionism on a particular employer. Well, that's when the social basis of that deteriorates. Like, there was a time when most restaurants this size in New York were union. Here's why. Essentially, that's how you organize. They organize all the restaurant workers in the city. They had these big area-wide strikes. Then if you ran a restaurant in the city and you were above a certain size, you were going to pay union conditions. Well, over time, when we go to Wagner Act-style unionism where you're winning elections, you're going to just certify the union in your restaurant. Also, the racketeering thing kind of turned into its opposite, where there were rackets where you would sell people a fake union contract that was below union standards. Mm. There was another labor racketeer that was, of all things, a Baptist minister from Kansas named Homer Martin. Mm. And he had set up a union that split off from the UAW, and they end up in New York, and they end up selling fake union contracts. And he teams up with a wise guy named John Diagardi, better known as Johnny Dio. And Johnny Dio and Homer Martin, this Baptist minister from Kansas and this Bronx wise guy, teamed up, and they would sell fake union contracts to businesses, including restaurants. So suddenly now it's possible to get a fake union contract. Mm. And you had, well, getting back to Kennedy Airport, you had Harry Davidoff, who ran Local 295, which was the legitimate Teamsters local at Kennedy. He set up his son running a local, Local 858, and if you paid the right people money, you could get a substandard contract with Local 858. So you might literally have in the same hangar. There'd be some of the people with 295 people getting full union scale. Some people would be 858 people getting less than the union scale.
And the racketeers made their money off the differential between those workers' wages, essentially. Right. They would get some portion of like the extra profits, the super profits on top of that. Now, you haven't yet answered my trollish question about the Cornell-educated labor staffers, because you know I think we're all familiar with the way you've laid out the problems with the mob racketeering.
Right.
But now with the mob gone, you would think that workers' self-organization, workers' democracy, the strike as a way to impose our will on capital would have a chance. But instead, despite the defenders of the NLRB like our Eric Loomis or Lichtenstein or whoever it is, we continue to see not just a decline in union density, but a great mismatch in this country between the percentage of people who say they would want a union, which is up there in the 60-70%, and the declining number of people who actually have a contract. So talk a little bit about this NLRA system, the Taft-Hartley system, the ways in which even like on its own terms, the labor law regime in this country has failed.
Well, prior to 1935, if you wanted to organize a union, basically what you'd do is you'd organize a group of workers and you would get them to go on strike, and you would, if the strike was effective, the employers would have to end up signing an agreement with you, or they would make them join an area-wide agreement with similar employers. After 1935, you have to win an election at each individual company, and you have to sign an agreement with them, and they can make you sign an agreement different than what their competitors are paying. So also, the thing about NLRB elections is they're very complicated. There's a whole lot of rules with doing an NLRB election. Suddenly, you need a bunch of attorneys, and you need a bunch of union organizers who are people that are specialists who went to college and studied about how the labor law works, how federal labor law works, if you're organizing public sector workers, how your state public employee laws work, and the details of running an election is very complicated. It's something you literally have to go to school to know mm-hmm. what to do. You can't just be, say, like when Jimmy Hoffa started organizing unions, he's a 16-year-old kid who's working in a warehouse for Kroger supermarkets. He's just some guy. Mm-hmm. And he made friends with an older worker who was a socialist, and the young kid and the older socialist got together, and they just organized a strike of the people that unloaded the freight trains with the fresh vegetables on them. Wagner Act unionism, you can't do that anymore. You have specialists. And the problem is, first of all, the schools that teach you how to be a union organizer are the same schools that people who do labor relations stuff for management go to. Mm. So you're in, like, say,
you're sitting across in class from the same person who's going to be trying to break your union strike.
Right, and that person is your peer, and the members of your union you have nothing in common with.
Right.
So say if you're like the lady that just got elected president of United HGRE, it's a union that's been mostly female most of its existence. They just now got around to electing a woman president 120 years after they were founded. And, you know, she went to Yale. Mm. Now, who does United HGRE represent? That's a long-ass name. I'm not going to say the whole thing. But it's people that work in garment factories, people that work in commercial laundries, people that work in casinos and hotels, people that work in restaurants. But the current person that runs the union, she went to Yale. Her predecessor, a gentleman named D. Taylor, for some reason he don't spell out his first name. He just uses an initial.
He's incognito. Right.
Well, he also came from that Ivy League background.
Yeah.
He comes from the same background as the people that do labor relations for Sodexo Marriott. Those might be his classmates. That's someone, oh, yeah, I remember you when we went to Cornell. Yeah, we used to hang out together. Yeah, we used to play darts at that bar. Those are his peers. Now, who actually works in casinos and hotels and restaurants? Well, blue-collar people, mostly immigrants, mostly minorities. So it's like, but the people who run the union, these Ivy League people have nothing in common with them. Those people aren't their peers. You know, if you're bargaining a contract, and one of the issues in the contract is how many rooms you're going to clean in a day, which is an issue for hotel housekeepers, and you've never changed a bed in a hotel room in your life, but management, you're with someone who is your former classmate, and you're discussing that with them, it's like, well, you know, those women, they could do 26 rooms a day. They could do, instead of 24, they could do more. You know, and of course, remember, and this is, you know, one of the original sins of American labor is race. You're a Caucasian person, they're Caucasian. Who cleans hotel rooms in America? Yeah.
I think we all know
that. Like this color or darker clean hotel rooms in America.
Absolutely.
And that's, so, you know, it. The problem with NLRB model unionism is it's the workers get very insulated from the life of their union. In some extreme cases, like in the Service Employees International Union, they have locals that cover multiple states. Mm-hmm. The local that represents janitors and security guards in New York, local 32BJ, it represents workers from Boston to Richmond. Now, it's a local with 200,000 members across multiple states.
Try going to a union meeting.
Right. And again, that's not a bug. That's a feature.
Right.
And, you know, the people that run that union, they never were a security guard. They were never a janitor. They never ran a freight elevator in an office building. And the problem is that the NLRB model of unionism, the thing that makes unions function is their ability to disrupt production through strikes.
Yes.
And these people also, ideologically, these are very smart people, very smart, well-educated people. They really believe in corporatist labor relations.
Yes.
They really believe in labor management government partnership.
It's literally their job to be the people interceding between the rank and file and the bosses.
Exactly.
We have given, in the course of like a half hour, 45 minutes, like a million ways to get blackpilled about trade unions in the United States, whether it's the mob historically or whether it is the National Labor Relations regime. I want to kind of segue now to maybe some more hopeful discussion. It's going to be a discussion about the left, so maybe not super hopeful. But
I left that day with a lunchbox full of gears. I've never considered myself a thief, but GM wouldn't miss just
Hey, folks. Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.
Now, up to now, my plan went all right till we tried to put it all together one night. And that's when we noticed that something was definitely wrong. The transmission was a 53 and the motor turned out to be a 73. And when we tried to put in the bolts, all the holes were gone. So we drilled it out so that it would fit. And with a little bit of help from an adapter kit, we had that engine running just like a song. Now the headlights, there was another sight. We had two on the left and one on the right. But when we pulled out the switch, all